Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, the country is still coming to grips with the fact that Donald Trump won. Why did he win? What is he doing with all of his appointments? Where are we going from here? And so we've got different perspectives on that. We've got the senator-elect from California, Adam Schiff, who, of course, has been a nemesis of Trump for so many years, but talking about how he could potentially work with him, which is an indication of how the politics has shifted a little bit. A really interesting conversation with former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, who's now running for California governor and really slams a lot of what the party just did and what's happening in the state when it comes to oil refineries, and really interesting newsworthy comments from him on the show. And then Harvey Levin, our pal from TMZ, the founder there, really just goes off. I had a conversation with him. I thought this would be great on TV, and it turns out that it is. So, and on the podcast. So, and on this podcast, we have extended conversations with all of them. They all were great, and we had to trim it down for TV, but here you get the whole thing, which is the value of subscribing to this podcast. So let's start with Senator-elect Schiff, and our conversations begins with a clip from Schiff on our show back in January 2023.
Great to be with you, and great to make the announcement on your show.
In January of 2023, Congressman Adam Schiff announced his run for U.S. Senate right here on The Issue Is. In November of 2024, Schiff won that race and is now the U.S. Senator-elect from California. Senator-elect Adam Schiff, welcome back to The Issue Is. First time I've ever called you Senator-elect. Congrats to you.
Thanks so much. Great to be back on your show. I think kicking off on your show was the way to go. It's a good luck charm.
It was the key to victory. I think every political scientist is saying that, so I'm glad that you pointed that out. you have waited a long time for this. I know this result was pretty much expected for the last few months, but describe the emotions of this race being called for you and being the next senator from California.
Well, my first feeling was, one of incredible gratitude to millions of people throughout the state that voted to send me to the U.S. Senate to represent them. It's such an incredible place, California, with amazing people, with an incredible economy, with great entrepreneurs and innovation, with great natural beauty. And the idea of representing that wonderful state was just overwhelming, and I'm so grateful to people for their trust and support, and look forward to getting to work and delivering for them.
Your Republican opponent, Steve Garvey, called you on election night. What did he say?
We actually spoke, I think, the day after, and he was very gracious. I thanked him for the call, which is a classy thing to do. People don't always do that anymore these days. We talked about getting together after the holidays. I expressed my appreciation that I think for the most part, or both of our campaigns kept it a very positive campaign, even while all the campaigns going around us became so very negative. So it was a good conversation, and look forward to the opportunity to get to go with him after the dust settles.
As a kid who grew up watching baseball, was it sort of wild to be running against Steve Garvey?
I could tell I was running against a vigorous competitor who was, determined to do everything he could to win. It was, wonderful to see the Dodgers win the World Series. And so I got to enjoy that part of Dodgerdom, even if I was running against the Dodger.
Yeah, the Dodgers bringing everybody together, except for Giants fans. Sorry, guys. So you have been warning against Trump and Trumpism as much as anybody in this country. Why do you think more than 70 million Americans supported him?
I think people voted the economy, and that is so often the case. We have a challenge facing the American people that is unlike we've had in the past. That is, today, the problem is not that people are out of work. Unemployment's very low. The problem is that they are working, and they're still struggling to get by. And I think people were voting their pocketbook. They were voting their hopes for a better economy. And even though we made a lot of progress on inflation, prices are still well higher than they were before the pandemic. So I think people were voting for who they thought would do a better job with the economy. And much as we tried to make the case that that was Democrats, Donald Trump succeeded making the case that that would be Republicans, and we have to respect the will of the voters.
So how do Democrats message better?
Well, I think it's more than message, honestly. I think that, we have a structural challenge with our economy, in that people are working so hard. They're working often harder than their parents' generation and struggling more. And we've got to address this. We have huge income inequality in the country now. People are doing well or doing even better. But the middle class is losing ground and working families are losing ground. And I think whatever party is able to speak to that, to address that, to come up with plans to help people enjoy the American dream is going to enjoy the support of the American people. So I think it's more than message. I think it requires a bold agenda. And I would begin with housing. That's going to be my focus in the U.S. Senate from day one, is building more housing, bringing down the cost of housing, dealing with homelessness, bringing down the cost of food and medicine, raising people's incomes and standard of living. That's where I think we need to be laser focused.
How do you get that done if you're a junior senator in the minority in a body that requires 60 votes to do almost anything?
Well, you have to find common ground. And when Donald Trump was president in those first 4 years, I was the chair of the Intel Committee or the ranking member of the Intel Committee, and I had to get the intelligence bills passed out of committee, and we did. I worked with Devin Nunes. We fought over other things, but we decided we were going to get the national security work of the country done, and we did. I'm going to look for partners across the aisle. I'm going to seek out Republican senators that share my concern about housing costs, that want to incentivize the building of new housing, bring down childcare costs. There's a lot of bipartisan room for agreement on these things. We're going to have to find it in an era of closely divided government. We're going to have to find ways to work together.
Are there any specific Republican senators you've already started that conversation with?
There are. I've got some of my Republican House colleagues that will be in the Senate, some of the Republican senators that I've formed a relationship with over the years, and look forward to developing those relationships further. And the model for me really is Dianne Feinstein. She developed good relationships across the aisle. She got to know the issues up and down the state. I want to do that. I want to spend a lot of time in the Central Valley understanding the agriculture industry, which is so important to California and the rest of the world. I want to make sure that I'm delivering for everyone, whether people voted for me or they didn't. I want to be their representative.
Trump has suggested you are part of the enemy from within and that he may use the military against American citizens. We know you've dealt with death threats from Trump supporters in the past. Are you concerned for your safety?
I think all of us these days have to be concerned about our safety, and I am. I'm taking precautions. But at the same time, nothing's going to deter me from doing my job. In the first part, I'm going to focus on getting things done and delivering. The former president has talked about bringing costs down and strengthening our economy. If that's where his focus is, then he'll find a willing ally. On the other hand, should he move to try to take away the rights and freedoms of Californians, should he move to try to tear down the guardrails of our democracy, as before, he will meet a vigorous opponent in me. So I'm going to start hoping for the best and working to deliver for California. That's going to be my priority, but I will do whatever is necessary to protect the rights and freedoms of my constituents.
So what you're saying is, are you ready and willing to work with Donald Trump?
I am. If he's willing to work to bring down the cost of living, if he's willing to work together to address the economic challenges facing the American people, I will work with anyone, including the former president. I will look for partnerships across the aisle. People elected me to do a job and to deliver for California, and that's what I intend to do.
You were one of the most prominent people to call for Joe Biden to drop out this summer. Now that we've got 2020 hindsight, would it have been better for the party if Joe Biden would have announced in, say, late 2022 or early 2023 that he wasn't running and allowed for a competitive open primary?
I'll let commentators try to answer that question. I think it's very unclear, candidly. If we had a competitive Democratic primary, that could have worked out well or could have been very ugly. So there's really no telling what that course would have meant. I think this was a strongly anti-incumbent election. It's an anti-incumbent mood around the world. People are voting their dissatisfaction with the economy, and that's what we were confronting. In that respect, it was always going to be an uphill challenge. I respect the decision that the president made to step aside. I think it was the right decision. Whether that decision made earlier or not at all would have changed the result, I don't know. I'm going to keep my focus, though, on the future and how I can deliver for the people of California.
Do you know yet what committees you're going to be assigned to or what your main focus is going to be?
I don't know yet what the committee assignments will be. Part of that will deal with, the new majority and the ratio of the seats on different committees. But I'm going to look to try to find committee assignments where I can deliver on housing and deliver on childcare and bring costs down, and also reinforce the strength of our democracy, the guardrails of our democracy. I'll be looking to do all of those things to protect the country. I want to continue working on national security issues as I have in the past. So many continuing issues, but also want to make sure that I'm in a position, along with my fellow Senator Alex Padilla, where we have the state covered. And we're able to, working together, deliver for people.
I know you feel so strongly that some of these democracy issues are so important, January 6th, so important. Do you think that maybe there was a disconnect with the American people that may have said, yeah, all that's great, but if I can't afford my groceries, I don't have time to watch the January 6th hearing. I'm trying to make ends meet.
I don't think people voted for Donald Trump because they liked his anger and division and vitriol, or his threats to our democracy. I don't think that's why people voted for him. I think they voted for him despite all those things. I think they voted for him because they thought that he might improve the economy more than what Democrats were offering. That's the challenge I think facing the Democratic Party is to restore confidence that we are the champions of working people. We are the better stewards of the economy. Historically, that's very much been the case. But we need to do a better job in outlining our plans to lift people up and improve their quality of life and make the American dream more possible. That, to me, is the challenge for my party. And I look forward to getting together after the dust settles and strategizing about what big, new, bold policy proposals we can offer, how we communicate those to voters, and how we lift up working class families and the middle class. That's why I got into politics. That's what still what motivates me, and I want to make sure my party's leading the way.
I know you just suggested that you'll do this later, but if you had to real succinctly say what is the Democratic economic agenda, real succinctly for people to understand, what is the Democratic economic agenda?
But if you're working hard in America, you can earn a good living. You can provide for yourself and your family. You can live in a safe neighborhood. You can put food on the table. You can have a dignified retirement and access to health care. That's the Democratic vision for a good economy, and we have to make it so. And I think middle-class families feel they've been losing ground over not just the last few years, but over the last few decades. It is a bipartisan challenge facing the country. In this global economy, in this increasingly automated economy, and I'm going to be laser focused on doing everything I can to help people get ahead, and enjoy the American dream.
We like to end with stuff that's fun on this show. So one thing I noticed that you did on the campaign trail was spend a lot of time with dogs. You called them dogs for democracy. What did that do for your soul?
Well, one thing I discovered, Alex, is you can give the Gettysburg Address and maybe five people listen to you, but if you're holding a dog, then everybody's going to listen to what you have to say, or it'll just put a smile on your face. I'm an animal lover and dogs in particular, and so I always look for those opportunities to connect with my four-legged friends.
Very nice. And we'll end with personal issues, which I know you love, to get to know you a little bit better. I know you haven't had a whole lot of time for cultural favorites recently, but just whatever comes to mind in terms of your recent interests in between all the campaigning and traveling. Here we go. We're going to put 30 seconds up on the clock. What is the favorite TV show you've binged recently?
Oh, gosh. I think The Old Man,
Jeff
which Jeff
Bridges,
Bridges.
Your favorite.
Yeah.
Favorite
Is a great
movie
one.
you've seen recently?
Oh, you know, I haven't really. Oh, okay. The Quiet Girl. It's a Irish film. It's pretty incredible.
Favorite book you've read recently?
Grant, and that's been a while, so I haven't read anything particularly great since I read Grant.
That's Ron Chernow. It's so long that you could still be reading it. And lastly, maybe you get a few days off finally after this multi-year campaign. What's the best way to relax?
For me, it's going out to dinner and a movie with my wife. And Alex, I have to tell you, on election night, somebody gave me a quote from one of my favorite movies, The Big Lebowski, which kind of summarized the election this year for me. And that quote is, "Sometimes you eat the bear, and sometimes the bear, well, he eats you." And that seemed to be a good summary of things this year.
Which one are you in this scenario? Are you eating or
Well,
being eaten?
a little of both, honestly, this election.
Yeah. Our thanks to Senator Schiff. Now to a conversation with Antonio Villaraigosa. But we begin that conversation with a clip from our pal, Brian Goldsmith.
You are seeing non-college educated Latinos begin to vote like non-college educated white voters. And that is bad news for Democrats because non-college educated white people are at the core of the Trump coalition.
Political strategist Brian Goldsmith on Katie Couric, making the point that Latinos, as they assimilate over the generations, are starting to change their political vote patterns. Look at this number. Trump gained 35% among Latino support in 4 years. That's pretty astounding. With us to discuss is Antonio Villaraigosa. He was LA's first Latino mayor in 130 years, is now running to be the next governor of California. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Great to be with you as always, Alex.
Good to see you. So what happened with Latinos specifically?
Well, they're invisible. I mean, let's be honest. One party demonizes them, and they're invisible with the other party. And they have been for a long time. I said a long time ago, 6 years ago to be exact, that we can't be a party of just people that drive a Tesla and not a Toyota pickup or ride a bus like my mother did. You know, people have been saying for a while now that the economy is important to them, that paying for gas and groceries is something they're struggling with, that the rents are too high, that there's not enough housing, that their kids, they're worried that their kids are not going to have the life they had. It used to be that home ownership was part of the American dream, and now renting an apartment with two other roommates close to your house is part of the dream. So I think we just weren't listening to Latinos and people that don't have an education. It doesn't, if you don't have a college education, it doesn't mean you're stupid. It means that you have other experiences. They're the majority of people in this country last time I looked. And you would think that we would be focusing on the majority, but we didn't. And so from my vantage point, what Brian said is true. More and more, you're seeing Latino voters, particularly Latino males, vote like white males who don't have an education, because only 13% of Latinos have a college education, a 4-year college education.
Do you think the politics of immigration have changed too, as generations are here longer legally?
Well, we've seen this movie before. We saw it in 1994. With Proposition 187. Look, many of us said for a long time, every country has a right to enforce their immigration laws, to strengthen their border. I believe, and most do, that we ought to have a legal path to citizenship. Now, on the issue of the recent immigration, there's been concern. They came supposedly under the refugee status, in other words, political refugees. Most of them were crossing the border for economic reasons. So, yes, it's true. People were concerned about that, particularly the numbers of people. The Republicans had an opportunity to deal with a pretty tough bill on that issue, and they refused to do it for politics. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that immigration is an issue, particularly on the border states, but all across the country. The question is, are we going to do smart things around immigration or the mass deportation of people,
right,
which would completely undermine the California economy, the Texas economy, the Arizona, New Mexico economies.
Well, let's talk about that, this idea, because Trump says his big thing is mass deportation. A lot of polls suggest that mass deportation is popular as a concept. Do you think that that's realistic? Do you think he actually wants to do that? And what sort of impact does that have on California?
It's popular until it isn't. Hmm. When people start seeing their family members, their employees, when we can't find dishwashers and cooks in our restaurants, when our fields are empty of workers, and our construction sites are missing the number of workers that we need, that's going to change. Nobody's ever questioned the idea that we should prioritize, as an example, people who commit serious crimes and felonies. But the notion that we're going to deport 11 million people may sound good to some people right now, but wait till it actually happens.
Well, and people that think that housing affordability is an issue now, that food prices is an issue now. Could you imagine if you took all of that out of the economy, the price increase that would be on everybody?
Well, that and tariffs,
yeah,
which the estimates are from $6,000 to $8,000 a family each year if we were to raise tariffs the way that, Trump has said. Look, I think people are in this state. There's no question. This is the lowest Democratic vote since Bush, I think, in 2004.
2004.
There's no question that there's, a course correction that people are looking for. I think they're looking for a course correction on crime.
Well, yeah,
that's why I got behind Proposition 136. Look, I said from the beginning, I lost an election because the other side said I was going to be soft on crime. So the first thing I did, and I learned something, crime is important to people until it's not. So, when I became mayor, LA was one of the most violent big cities in America. When I left, we had 1950 levels of crime. And so when I saw people say, for instance, that crime is down from 2 years ago, people don't feel it. And when people don't feel it, they want a course correction.
Sure.
And when we have, the kind of,
images like we're looking
images
at there,
like we're looking at there, of people just breaking into stores multiple times and stealing things. When you read about the follow home robberies and people robbing you when you have a watch in the most affluent areas,
sure,
of the city, people say, hold it. It doesn't mean they want to return to the days of mass incarceration. I'm the former president of the ACLU. I chaired the anti-death penalty initiative twice while I was mayor of LA. Mm. Nobody is for, or certainly I'm not, for the mass incarceration of people. But when you exaggerate like they did on Proposition 136, most of the people didn't buy it,
yeah,
about 70%.
Well, let's talk.
And by the way, I was the only candidate running for governor that actually took that position, yeah, because I listened to people.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that issue. So Prop 36 on the issue of crime was put forward. It increases certain drug penalties, theft penalties, passed overwhelming, over 70% of people backed it. You backed it, but almost all of the Democratic leadership did not. Governor Newsom did not. Why do you think there's such a divide on this issue between the state Democratic Party and where actual voters are, most of whom are Democrats?
Remember I just said that I think people are looking for common sense. They are not looking for ideologues. I came out of the civil rights movement. I was president of the ACLU. I am unabashedly against the mass incarceration of people. When we took crime down to 1950 levels, it wasn't just with more cops or taking guns off the streets. It was dramatically expanding after school programs and summer jobs. It was an all of the above approach. The notion that we're just going to follow ideology and not common sense, I think, is where people lost their way.
Yeah, but why do you think the Democratic Party leadership doesn't see that?
Because they're not listening to people. Because they spend too much time focused on what was the mass incarceration of people and didn't see the need for a course correction. It didn't mean we have to go back to three strikes, you're out, like one newspaper opined. It means that at the end of the day, we can balance and say, hold it. I think we need a course correction. If, by the way, on the drugs, if you don't get rehab after three times and get arrested for serious drugs like fentanyl, crack cocaine, yes, you go back to jail. It doesn't mean you go back to jail for 60 years. It means you go back to jail until you realize that, hey, you need rehab. Now, speaking of that, as governor, I'm going to make sure we have enough, resources for drug rehab programs, because that's important.
Yeah,
they made the argument that we don't have enough. We've got to ensure that they do. But that can't be a reason why we take the position that you can keep on getting arrested for drug crimes and never go to jail.
Sure.
That didn't pass the smell test.
So you're running for governor. I know you ran against Governor Newsom the last time. This Prop 36 is one difference between the two of you, but what do you think is the biggest difference between you, Antonio Villaraigosa, as governor potentially going forward, and the current governor?
You know, look, I'm not running against the current governor. I'll tell you what's the difference between me and the other candidates very clearly. I've made it clear. When I see some in the legislature talk about closing down refineries and making it almost impossible to operate refineries, which, by the way, produce the cleanest fuels in the United States of America, lay off thousands of union workers, are we going to just push more of those people to Trump? You know, at the end of the day, why aren't we building transmission in this state? Why is it that last year Texas passed up California on solar and wind? Why is it that Florida and Texas are drawing down more money from the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act than California? I'll tell you why. We spend too much time setting these goals that, while maybe attainable, we're not doing anything to make them happen. We let the perfect get in the way of the good, and we don't focus our efforts on building the transmission we need and the battery power that we need so that we can get to 100% renewables. We're not going to, we have people that say that natural gas shouldn't be a transition fuel. Well, we don't have the battery power right now. We're working on it to do all solar and all, wind. As mayor, number one American city in reducing carbon emissions, number five in the world. You know, so when I hear these people that constantly take positions which are ideological and rigid and not willing to drive down a lane where we're moving forward just on ideology, I'm not for that. And I think that's what distinguishes me from the other candidates and some other Democrats.
On that point then, 2035 in California right now, there's supposed to be the end of the sale of gas-powered cars. That's a mandate that Governor Newsom has supported. Would you support that? Would you change that?
I've said real clearly, I'm supportive of that. Well, then why aren't we building transition? Yeah. Transmission lines. We need more transmission if we're gonna get there. All those goals sound great. When I was mayor, I actually met them.
Yeah.
And I met them because we were smart and we were focused, and we didn't let the perfect get in the way of the good. And I think too many people are looking for perfect. And I'll tell you something, most people are looking for results. Yeah. And that's what I'm focused on as, you know, someone who's a proven problem solver.
Let's have a little bit of fun to end this. We play personal issues on this show. It's just 30 seconds on the clock to get to know your cultural favorites. Get away from some of the talking points. Here we go. What is the TV show that you've binged recently?
Oh, that one's easy. Handmaiden.
Handmaid's Tale, right?
Handmaid's Tale.
Okay. Best book you've read lately.
It's a book by David Leonhardt, something about what America used to be, about the economy and how Democrats have forgotten the little guy. And David Leonhardt, I can't remember the name.
Okay.
It's a great book.
Okay, and who's your favorite musical artist?
You know, it's still Tupac.
Tupac?
Yeah. You know why? I just love the way he spoke. He had his ear to the ground. He spoke to the pain of young people. He also spoke to their aspirations, and I love, my favorite is Keep Your Head Up. You know, we gotta respect our women, and we gotta be accountable.
Our thanks to Mayor Villaraigosa. Really interesting, newsy comments there. It'll be interesting to see how he fits into the governor's race. Clearly, he's trying to take out a lane. And a lot of what he's talking about is in line with where voters were during this last election, which is a different place than where they were when he ran for governor the last time around. All right, let's end this conversation with Harvey Levin from TMZ. He really goes off in this, but we start with a clip from President Trump's election night.
This is a magnificent victory for the American people that will allow us to make America great again.
The whole country is still processing Donald Trump's big historic election win. So how did he do it? And what can Democrats learn for the future? TMZ founder Harvey Levin has known Donald Trump for many years. Here they are filming Harvey's show Objectified at Trump Tower before Trump became president. Harvey has some strong views on this, and he joins us now from TMZ. Harvey, welcome back to The Issue Is.
My pleasure, Alex.
So how did Trump do this?
Well, I'm not sure he did it as much as the Democrats did it, to be honest with you. You know, look, there are a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump who don't like him. And you got to then ask why. And I think there are a lot of reasons. But if I had to pick one that really pushed people toward somebody with whom they disagree on a lot of issues and even don't like personally, I would say the Democrats have become bullies. And I don't know how else to put it. But when you look at what the media did and what people in the party did, people who led the party, it's not about what they call Donald Trump, because that's all fair game. But when you start calling, you know, people who are inclined to vote for him for various reasons, misogynists and racists and garbage, you know, deplorables, it is just shaming people into revolting. And I think that there has been a level of bullying. You know, look at Hollywood, Alex. You know, that if somebody supports Trump in Hollywood, a lot of them get blacklisted, and they talk about that. So I think there's got to be some introspection on tolerance, that, you know, this is a party that talks about tolerance and inclusion, and which is great, you know, when it comes to, you know, uplifting, you know, groups that, you know, have experienced prejudice. But when they deal with their opponents, they got to kind of show the same grace. And I think they lost that.
Well, and there were a lot of Democrats that seemed to be telling voters, don't believe your own eyes on a lot of different issues. When it comes to immigration, they were saying that the border was secure when bipartisan majorities said that they didn't like the policy there. When it comes to the economy, they were telling people Bidenomics was working when people were paying more for their groceries. When Joe Biden, people were saying his age is a huge problem, and people, you know, they were saying that that wasn't an issue. It seems like the party got mad at anybody who would dare to criticize any of these things that actual voters are caring about, and doing so was essentially making you pro-Trump and anti-democracy.
I think that's exactly right. And it really does kind of get into that territory of just bullying and just showing this lack of tolerance that, you know, when you that, listen, the media amplified this, and you know that as well as anybody, that the media was pushing this narrative. And I think, you know, in many ways, lots of traditional media, certainly cable, they used wishful thinking that they masqueraded as political analysis. And, you know, they wanted a certain result and were pushing that result. And I think a lot of voters saw right through that. And, you know, I think people who otherwise might have given Kamala Harris more of a shot, I think they were driven away from her. I think this was the Democrats losing the election as much as it was Trump winning.
And it also seems to be a problem that a lot of the Democratic leadership and the media, they're all college-educated people that surround themselves with people that have similar worldview, and they literally don't talk to anybody with any different point of view, so they have no way of understanding where a big chunk of this country is. And a lot of those people wanted to give them the middle finger for that.
Absolutely. You know, there was a Yale professor on one of the cable shows a couple of days ago who was a psychiatrist who was saying that any member of the LGBTQ community should feel very comfortable shunning a family relative over the holidays who voted for Donald Trump, because they're not with you. They don't support you. They're against you. And I'm a member of that community, and I know relatives who did support Trump, but they're not anti-LGBTQ. And it's that, again, it's that kind of lack of tolerance that gets amplified by the media. And I agree with you. I think the middle finger was front and center here. You know, another example, Alex, is, you know, there are people who believe that people born biological males should not participate in women's sports. That's a fair debate to have, and you can debate it. But what's happened is you are then transphobic if you take that point of view. And that doesn't mean you're transphobic. It means you disagree on a debatable point.
Right.
And I think that gets, again, to this lack of tolerance. And I think the voters really read it this time. Look, it's complicated. It's the economy. It's immigration. You know, it is, you know, Biden dropping out too late. I think some of it is misogyny. Some of it is racism. Mm-hmm. All of that is combined. But there's this overarching thing about, you know, Democrats just not giving the time of day to people that they disagree with. And I think that costs them dearly.
You know, I was co-hosting TMZ Live with you this summer.
You were?
And we thought Harris was going to pick someone else as vice president. Here's a clip.
I'm going to bet that it's going to be Josh Shapiro.
I'm with you. I'm totally with you.
It's a clear argument. So the most important swing state in the country is Pennsylvania.
So they didn't do that. The idea was that Tim Walz was going to be this person. Apparently they weren't watching TMZ Live. I don't know how that happens. Tim Walz was supposed to be the person to connect to men. Clearly that didn't work. Where do the Dems go from here?
Well, I have some strong thoughts about this. They cannot. I mean, look, the country is in the middle. They're, you know, the country is moderate, and they're moderate on the Republican side, I believe, even with MAGA. I think a lot of people, if given a real choice, they tend to be more toward the center. And I think Democrats are there, too. I don't think there's a huge difference between, I don't know, 70-75% of the country. I think they're in a fairly narrow range, and there may be a line in the middle. They're not that far apart. I think if the Democrats, and this is somebody, you know, I've lived a long life, if they've learned anything from here, it's, yeah, I mean, you may have these great ideas if you are, you know, a progressive, which is really, you know, the idea of calling it progressive. If you've got a right wing, you've got a left wing. And I don't think you want to go to the left wing if you're a Democrat. And I think you need to move toward the center. And I think that's bad news for Gavin Newsom. I'll tell you that. I think it's bad news for Gavin Newsom. People don't perceive him that way. And, you know, we've already now seen how Republicans used California elected officials to score points in a presidential election. I don't see how that flies next time.
And it'll be a lot harder for Gavin Newsom, who has a lot more ownership of homelessness and a lot of the California issues than Kamala Harris did, because she wasn't involved with as much of that. And one other thing, since you're the TMZ guy, and we talked about this on your show, the impact of celebrities. We saw the big final push. We saw Beyonce, we saw Oprah, we saw Lady Gaga, we saw Taylor Swift, all the biggest celebrities out, Jennifer Lopez. Do you think they actually hurt her, maybe?
I don't think they hurt her, but I definitely don't think they helped her. And, you know, you and I talked about this, I think on a phone call once, that, you know, if they're really going for men and they're really trying to get men to come on their side, you know, the last event, it's Oprah Winfrey, Lady Gaga, and I mean, that's not going to get you the votes that you're trying to get. But I don't think celebrities, look, you may be a huge fan of Oprah Winfrey or Lady Gaga or Bruce Springsteen. How does Bruce Springsteen feel about the economy? I have no idea. I happen to love Bruce Springsteen, but I'm not going to say, oh God, I got to vote for so-and-so. I've got to vote for Kamala Harris because Bruce Springsteen supports her. He must know about the economy. No, I like his music. And I think that's the way most people see it. We're not lemmings. We don't just follow the people we like. And I think we got to give voters more credit that they're more independent thinkers than a lot of people give them credit for. And what matters to them? What matters to them is what affects them personally. That is a huge part of it. And I think the Democrats missed the boat on that. Like you said, you can, you know, I watch, I'm a news junkie, and I've seen ad nauseum, the economy is great, we're the best economy in the world, we're, you know, the shining star of globally. Well, that may be the case. But like you said, people at home are looking at their grocery bill, and they're saying, it just pisses me off even more that if we really are the best economy in the world, how did I miss the boat? Right. And I think that's what they needed to address, that's what they needed to connect to, and they failed.
And by the way, Bruce Springsteen, who is my favorite, does talk about a lot of economic conditions in his lyrics, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, but thing. Not the way he translates.
Your point is a good one. So thank you, Harvey. Always great to hear from you.
Enjoyed that conversation with Harvey Levin, Antonio Villaraigosa, and Adam Schiff all this week. Next week, we'll be back with more of The Issue Is. Thanks so much for listening this week. Really appreciate it. Appreciate any likes and comments and all the good stuff, and reach out in social media too. Let me know what you think of the show. We'll be back next week. See you then.